Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A small business owner in Cleveland talks taxes, toys, and the fiscal cliff. We'll tell you about some of the savviest shoppers in America. And what's inside America's banks? People in the know don't even know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, January 2nd. Thanks for joining us. Okay, so you've heard the news about Congress saving us from the fiscal cliff. End result, tax hikes on some wealthy Americans, Congress putting off spending cuts for a couple months. And if your next paycheck looks a bit smaller than usual, it's not your imagination. The fiscal cliff legislation lets a temporary reduction in the payroll tax expire. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at what effect the payroll tax cut had and how the expiration of that tax cut could affect everybody going forward.
2 years ago, Congress and President Obama agreed to cut the Social Security payroll tax by 2 percentage points in an effort to stimulate the economy. The thinking was if people had more money in their paychecks, they'd spend more. And they did, according to Scott Hoyt, an economist at Moody's Analytics.
When the tax was cut, then it gave consumers more money, and that added to growth.
Consumer spending rose by about $100 billion in 2011, Hoyt says, adding more than 0.5 percentage point to economic growth. And he expects GDP to fall by a similar amount now that the payroll tax has gone back up, because consumers won't spend as much. Consumers like Todd Winters, who stopped for a chat while getting lunch in downtown Washington. He figures he'll pay about $2,000 a year more now in payroll taxes.
You know, $2,000 is a nice vacation that I'll have to figure out some way of, you know, making do without it.
Retailers will take the first hit as consumers start spending less, and the pain will spread through the rest of the economy fairly quickly, says economist Carrie Leahy of Decision Economics.
And so it filters its way from the mall to the factory in probably a matter of 4 to 12 weeks.
But not everybody thinks paying more payroll tax is such a bad thing. Chris Beard, an engineer in St. Louis, says the Social Security Trust Fund needs all the money it can get.
Because, I mean, obviously there's all concern about Social Security and it not being there in 20 years or so. So I don't know that we needed to be giving people a tax break out of that pot.
Even if it does stimulate the economy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Small business people were repeatedly invoked in the debate over the fiscal cliff, how their taxes would be affected, their customers' taxes, and how that might affect business. Steve Presser is one of those small business people. He's the longtime owner of Big Fun Toy Store in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. He sells toys, collectibles, and Cleveland Pride products. Mr. Presser, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Bottom line, is this fiscal cliff deal good or bad for your small business?
I think it's going to be good in the sense that people now, some of the uncertainty has been answered. But for us, there's a lot of questions of what's going to be left after people pay a higher tax. It's our customer base that I'm more concerned about, not me individually.
And I assume, Steve, you're talking about payroll taxes going up.
Right. Payroll tax seems to have the most significant effect. Again, what happens with my client base and customers is what will be left after. My store is based on disposable income, and so that would be the strongest effect is what's left after for those to spend in small businesses like mine.
How was your Christmas season?
I actually had a really good Christmas season. Sales were up, and I'll run the final numbers actually today, but I can tell you almost every day was up, comparable to last year. So I'm enthusiastic about what's happening in retail.
Steve, you said it gives you a little more certainty. What does this fiscal cliff deal give you more certainty about as a business person?
Well, uncertainty and certainty, you know, affect people. When you don't know exactly what's going to happen, there's confusion out there. I think the certainty is we know what's going to happen economically for individuals. What we don't know is what's going to happen after that effect. So certainly in the sense of knowing that a deal has been reached helps out for businesses.
What What would you say on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you say your confidence in the economy is right now, your business confidence?
My confidence has gone up to the 7 or 8 range. I think that now people are starting to let loose with the purse strings a little bit more, and they're starting to enjoy and spend a little bit more. And I think that's what we need to have happen. And more spending, what we need more than most, is in the local marketplace, on mom and pops, the main streets.
Now, how many employees do you have right now?
Right now, we have roughly 5 employees.
Do you have enough confidence in the coming year that you are willing to hire anybody else?
I would hope. In fact, I'm looking to hire. I'm going to be hiring in the year 2013 because, again, I'm an optimist, and like most small businesses, we end up paying our employees before we pay the owners.
Right.
But I think we're going to start to see more of that, and you know, businesses have to be more flexible in how they run and operate their businesses.
Steve, are your personal income taxes going up under this deal or no?
No, I would love to say when you see a $450,000 number, I'd be like, oh my goodness, you know, it goes back to the days of the racetrack days of my father when you had a ticket that was over $1,000, you had to pay 20%. And his theory was, and a lot of people grumbled about it, oh my God, I got to give 20% back. His theory is he's got 80% more, he's got $800 more than what he started with. In theory, sure, we would all love to be paying that tax increase, small business people at the $450,000 level. So, you know, in the next years to come, sure, that would be my greatest joy would be to pay a tax increase on that level.
Okay. Steve Presser in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thanks so much, and happy, healthy New Year to the whole gang at APM.
Wall Street really, really, really liked the fiscal cliff deal today anyway. Details when we do the numbers. Now that the holidays are over, maybe you're determined to lose some of those extra pounds. But here's a word to the wise. Today's New Year's resolution can quickly go from, I'm going to get back in shape this year, to, my muscles really hurt, I'll just take a couple days off. Right. Apparently, that happens to as many as 4 out of 5 people who buy gym memberships. For the next few weeks, though, the workout rooms are full of best intentions. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Take a look at how busy health clubs are over the next few weeks, and you might think there's a fitness revolution underway. Losing weight is among the most popular New Year's resolutions, and that helps keep the industry financially fit.
This is definitely our prime time. This is our Super Bowl, so to speak.
Patrick Strait is a spokesman for Snap Fitness, a global chain of 24-hour workout centers.
Last year at this time, we added just around 100,000 new memberships. To put that in perspective, that's roughly 15% of all the new memberships that we added for the year.
But just wait a few weeks, and the lines for the treadmill and stationary bikes are likely to go away. Bankrate.com rates unused gym memberships among the top 10 money wasters. John LaRosa tracks the industry at Market Data Enterprises.
Some of the chains still like to try to sign you up for a yearly program, knowing full well that most people after 3 or 4 months are not going to be using the facility because they get tired and lose interest.
At least they're giving the job market a lift. At Fitness Evolution in the L.A. suburb of Redondo Beach, manager Rashad Green brings on extra help to handle the crowd. But he says the New Year's resolutioners are usually gone by the middle of February.
They're excited when they first come in, but after that, they just fall off. You know, we're creatures of habit, so they go right back to what they were doing.
Green says attendance usually spikes again in a few months when people start showing up to get their beach bodies ready for summer. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
November's elections showed Hispanics growing political clout, but it's their buying power that gets the attention of business. By one estimate, Hispanic consumers contribute more than $1 trillion to the economy. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, Latina shoppers in particular do their homework before they spend.
As part of her job, Vanessa Conniff-Platt puts down her foot over and over again. She's a professional flamenco dancer. It doesn't pay a lot, so she spends her money very carefully. The Mexican-American performer bought the dress she wears on stage at a thrift store.
It was a $5 dress that I can dress up with a scarf, and it looks like a complete flamenco outfit.
Conniff-Platt is an expert at uncovering hidden bargains.
There's deals out there. You just really have to look for them.
And wait for them. A friend recently bought shoes for $100 that most retailers sell for $150. Conniff-Platt liked the shoes but thought she could do better, so she held out.
I found the shoe for $70 and I immediately purchased it.
Her shopping habits reflect those of other Latinas. Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail. A recent survey by her company found that Latinas are about the savviest shoppers out there.
The Hispanic woman is very engaged in being a smart shopper, and by smart shopper I mean very focused on getting really good value for her family, so she's out looking for deals all the time.
The survey showed that, compared with other consumers, Latinas visit more stores to find bargains. They postpone purchases until items go on sale, and Liebman says Latinas are more likely to use the internet and mobile devices to identify deals.
She's using new digital technology at a relatively high level, and often higher level than Caucasian or African American shoppers.
40-year-old Maria Vela is one of those high-level, high-tech shoppers. From her house in the hills overlooking Los Angeles, she browses for clothes using a web browser.
I like to do most of my shopping online. I really don't like to go into malls or boutiques. I like to shop from the comfort of my home.
If an online retailer doesn't offer free shipping, she won't shop there. Today, the mother of two is shopping for socks. She sits on the couch armed with a laptop and checks her favorite website, a hub for bargain hunters called Retail Me Not.
Retail Me Not would have who's having socks on sale, who's having pants on sale. People post all these coupons on there, so it's kind of like a Facebook for coupons.
Wendy Liebman says major retailers are starting to appreciate the rise of the Latina shopper.
American retailers are getting there. I won't say that they are there by any means.
Hispanic-owned businesses don't necessarily have an advantage. According to Google, nearly 60% of them don't have a website. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, a new type of battery is in the works, and it could mean big things for cell phones and other gadgets.
Instead of lasting a day, the battery would probably last a day and a half to 2 days. But instead of it taking an hour to two to charge, it would take probably 5 minutes.
But first, let's do the numbers. Did investors like the fiscal cliff news? Well, the numbers say it all. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 308 points, 2.3%, to finish at 13,412. The Nasdaq charged up 92 points, 3%, to close at 3,112. The S&P 500 gained 36 points, 2.5%, to end at 1,462. Technology was a bright spot. Hewlett-Packard shot up nearly 5.5%. Apple blossomed 2.2%. The car sharing company Zipcar raced up 47% today after a buyout by a traditional car rental giant, Avis. The Avis Budget Group drove up nearly 5%. Citigroup hauled in 4.25%. Bank of America climbed 3.75%. France's CAC 40 reeled in 2.5%. Germany's DAX and Britain's FTSE each stepped up 2.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. How many people drove new cars off the lot at the end of the year? Automakers are slated to report sales for December. A look at how the holiday shopping season wrapped up. Chain stores are scheduled to reveal what ended up in the cash registers last month. And here's something you can't live without, the drinking straw. The modern straw was patented 125 years ago. So grab whatever beverage your New Year's resolution allows you to drink and slurp it up. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner, in for Kai Ristall. When you hear the words big banks, what comes to mind? Too big to fail, government bailout, trading losses, derivatives nobody understands? Well, 4 years after the financial crisis and supposedly serious financial reform, people still don't trust banks. Public faith in banks is at an all-time low. Jesse Eisinger writes about why in this month's cover story in The Atlantic. Mr. Eisinger, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
You say that big banks are too big and too opaque. What do you mean by opaque?
Well, what we talk about is that the bank financial statements are truly incomprehensible. And we're not talking about incomprehensible to a layman, to a plumber, or to your grandmother. We're talking about incomprehensible to people like the people who make accounting standards or incredibly sophisticated investors, even bank executives themselves. They don't understand what's inside giant American banks. And that really causes big problems both for the economy and for the fragility of our markets.
When did this happen? I mean, we had the 2008 financial crisis. Supposedly we had reforms. You would think then that things would be more transparent.
Exactly. Now, you know, after the financial crisis, we had big reforms. So you'd think that things were getting better. In fact, they're not. They're probably worse than ever. The biggest banks are even bigger than ever, and their financials are as opaque and impenetrable as ever.
If people in the know don't understand what's inside the big banks, what does that mean for the economy?
We have essentially dry rot. It creeps in very slowly. It's kind of unnoticed, but it means that the foundation is incredibly weak. So it means, one, that bankers are not making the kinds of loans that they should make because they don't understand their own institutions. They don't understand the vulnerabilities of their trading partners. And then the real problem is that the foundations are so weak because of this rot that the slightest wind can really blow the foundation down. So they're very vulnerable to a crisis. But meanwhile, we have this drag on the economy.
Now, you write about Wells Fargo, a supposedly very conservative bank, and you tried to decipher their annual report, and you didn't get very far or very much help from Wells Fargo. Tell us about that.
Wells Fargo is an incredibly popular bank, a solid American bank. And so we tried to go through their annual report to see what we could understand and what we couldn't understand. And it turns out that you can't understand enormous corners of the bank, trillions and trillions of dollars of assets that are both on their balance sheet and actually that they're exposed to, but that are technically off their balance sheet. And Wells Fargo, which complies with all the requirements, the legal requirements to disclose, as far as we could tell, doesn't help you understand them either.
You say that faith in banks is at an all-time low. What do you think can be done about that?
So one is that bankers need to go to prison if they are misleading.
And let me ask you, has any American banker ever gone to jail in our country?
Yes, but not since the financial crisis. American bankers used to go to prison when we had the savings and loan scandal, big debacle in the first Bush administration.
Right.
Lots of American bankers went to prison.
Right.
But since the financial crisis, not a single high-ranking bank executive from any of the major banks has gone to prison.
So aside from the threat of jail time, what else can be done to restore faith in banks?
I am hopeful. I think that you could have a kind of grand bargain where you said to these banks, look, you have to do all this, thousands and thousands of pages of paperwork for all these multiple regulators that we have overseeing you. And there could be a grand bargain that says we'll give you less regulation for much better, more meaningful disclosure. The banks would be, I think, would take that bargain and the American public would benefit.
Jesse Eisinger co-wrote the cover article, What's Inside America's Banks, in this month's edition of The Atlantic. Mr. Eisinger, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
From time to time on Marketplace, we follow a story that's not quite done. We watch an idea, a project, or a business come into being, sometimes all three. And that's what our friend Alex Chadwick is doing, following a scientist working on a new type of battery that's not quite there yet. Here's Alex.
Amy Prieto pushes past the door to her chemistry lab at Colorado State University and pauses for a moment. Three grad students cluster over a table. Another makes calculations on a glass board along the back wall.
The reason I love this space so much is because it has all of the equipment that you would need to make new materials.
Flasks, beakers, long black benchtops. It doesn't look much fancier than a high school chem lab. But this is where Amy is working to invent the future of energy with what she calls a 3D battery.
A normal battery is what we call 2D. It's layers of material that get stacked, and then typically they get rolled to make like your AA battery.
Like a sheet of paper.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So you take a sheet of paper and then you put a paste on it. You can think of it like paint, and that'll be one of the active materials of the battery. And then you add another layer and another different colored paint for the other side of the battery, and then you roll that together.
The movement of charged particles within batteries, they're called ions. That's what creates electricity. A 3D battery shortens the distance the ions travel. Instead of layers, Amy Prieto uses an airy construct called copper foam.
It's just like a sponge you could think about. And then we paint all the inside spaces with the different materials that you need for the battery. So instead of the ions having to go only in one direction to get from one layer to another, they can go in many different directions, but they don't have to go very far. So that's what I mean by a three-dimensional battery.
Okay, so if I had a Prieto battery to run my cell phone, how would that experience be different than my experience today?
So instead of a day lasting a day, the battery would probably last a day and a half to 2 days. But instead of it taking an hour to two to charge, it would take probably 5 minutes. What the people who make your phone will care about, so you would never see this, but what they would care about is that the battery itself is going to be about two-thirds the volume. So they can put a lot more functionality into your phone. Or you can imagine using the same size battery than as a regular battery now, but now it really will last 2 to 3 days instead. So you could think about it either way.
But, and this is a capital but, Prieto batteries are not about phones. They are about new battery architecture for phones and cars, and eventually for large-scale energy storage. Wind and solar energy will only really work when there's some kind of backup for when the wind dies and the sun sets. That's probably the biggest barrier to renewables, no storage. And that's the problem Amy Prieto is trying to solve.
From the very beginning, we made a list of all of the equipment and approaches that we were not allowed to use. Anything that could potentially be expensive.
Professor Prieto is hardly alone in her quest to reinvent the battery. Other players include General Motors, Bill Gates. She thought about them very carefully when the battery idea moved out of the lab and became an actual business.
So remember, I don't have any experience in manufacturing, but if a piece of equipment is expensive for me to buy in my academic lab, I'm assuming that a manufacturing plant built around that will have to be expensive. And that's actually going to be very important because every company in the world is trying to make batteries cheaper. And I was just assuming that if I am starting in my academic lab today, it's going to be several years before I could get this into the marketplace. So by then, the big companies will have driven down their costs as well. So I figured I better start really low. Otherwise, we won't be competitive by the time we get there.
The non-toxic part. Gone are the dangerous salts in a lithium-ion battery. Gone the volatile manufacturing process. Her battery uses chemicals like citric acid, which is common for preserving food.
The citric acid idea. My student, James, thought of that. I told him, I want this out of water. I want it at room temperature. I don't want you to use anything toxic. But he's the one who had this very clever idea that I thought was amazing. And it actually worked, which often when you come up with these crazy ideas, they don't work. I mean, most of science is things not working. But he made that work. And that was the platform for the whole rest of the battery.
which doesn't exactly fix things because the whole rest of the battery still has formidable problems. The Prieto researchers are working on them, so are other researchers, of course. Who knows who will get there? But in a year of our calling to check progress on various milestones, the Prieto group has hit the ones they've projected.
I think everybody wants better devices, they want organic food, they want better treatments for diseases.
Amy Prieto, in her small office upstairs from her lab, where her crew has checked off another milestone. She's not ready to say what it is yet. Scientists are careful, and so are people in startups. And she is both now, a research chemist who means to find the future of energy.
But all of that takes fundamental research, and that research takes quite a long time. And so I think communicating that sense of timing is very difficult. I'm not sure scientists necessarily do the best job of that.
We'll check to see how the Prieto battery is developing. From Bern, this is Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex Chadwick is the host of Bern, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions. It's produced with APM with support from the National Science Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. If you want to see pictures of Amy Prieto's lab, just go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, if you read the fine print on the fiscal cliff legislation, you'll find some rather interesting stuff. A rum tax to help support the Puerto Rican rum industry, a tax credit for electric bikes, a tax break to build race car tracks, and more tax-exempt financing for development around the former World Trade Center, which Bloomberg points out has benefited Goldman Sachs. What Congress hasn't managed to pass? A relief bill for Hurricane Sandy victims. Word is the new Congress will address that starting Friday. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 308 points, 2.3%. The NASDAQ powered up 92.3%. And the S&P 500 gained 36 points, 2.5%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Sarah Gardner. Join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.